Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Pirates Lafitte, The Treacherous World of the Corsairs of the Gulf, by William C. Davis. Narrated by Paul Woodson. He left a corsair's name to other times, linked with one virtue and a thousand crimes. Lord Byron, The Corsair, 1816. Preface. A Corsair's Name. On February 1, 1814, his publisher issued 10,000 copies of the great English poet Lord Byron's newest creation, The Corsair, three cantos of brilliant imagination that quickly sold out and went into a second printing. In an age that thrilled at the idea of bold buccaneers defying authority and convention, the poet's tale of the gallant Captain Conrad, a pirate risking even his beloved ship Medora for the love of a slave girl forced into a pasha's harem, fed the appetite of a generation hungry for romance and adventure. How much more appealing was it when Conrad, having the cruel pasha at his mercy, refused to take his life, even to save his own. It was his one virtue amid the life of crime. It is poetically typical of the lives of the brothers Pierre and Jean Lafitte, smugglers, merchants of contraband, revolutionaries, spies, privateers, and pirates as well, that so little in their memory fits their lives, and nothing less so than their persistent association with Byron's poetic epic. When he wrote it, the Lafittes were nothing more than minor figures on the crowded criminal landscape of early Louisiana. The poet likely never heard of either, and certainly his corsair was not patterned after Jean Lafitte. Conrad's single virtue was a romantic device, and had nothing to do with the Lafitte's celebrated and much exaggerated act of patriotism in aiding American forces in repelling the British at the Battle of New Orleans, which took place 3 weeks short of a year after publication of The Corsair. And yet, romance and legend will not yield to break the bond between poem and pirate. Throughout history, circumstances having nothing to do with poetry and romance occasionally conspire to produce an environment perfect for the explosion and spread of privateering and piracy, conditions that can vanish just as quickly as they appear. Never in the history of the United States were the times so ripe for it as in the years of young nationhood, when an adolescent America was beginning its spread across the continent amid the clash of immigrant colonial cultures, and a European war of gigantic proportions whose tremors upset the New World as well. In unsettled times, enterprising men found opportunity to build their own fortunes and wrest new nations away from old. Many tried, few succeeded. Some became legends. The privateer smugglers from Bordeaux and their ilk could not have flourished at their craft anywhere other than there and then, any more than the experience of the corsairs of the Gulf would have been the same without the brothers Lafitte. In the virtues and crimes of them all lay not just the stuff of romance, but zephyrs to fill the sails of the nascent American character. O'er the glad waters of the dark blue sea, our thoughts as boundless and our souls as free, far as the breeze can bear, the billows foam, survey our empire and behold our home. 1. Vintage Bordeaux, 1770 to 1803. Perhaps it is fitting for men whose lives so lent themselves to adventure and melodrama that their name traced its origins to a word meaning something like the song. For centuries, men named Lafitte inhabited the fertile reaches between the River Garonne and the Pyrenees Mountains that separated France from Spain. Proximity to the often lawless Pyrenees and life in the part of France most remote from the center of politics and culture in Paris, encouraged a spirit of independence in the region's inhabitants, and a tendency to look as much to the world as to their country for opportunity. Among those named for the song, That independence appeared in their stubborn refusal of a uniform spelling of their name. L-A-F-I-T-T-E, L-A-F-I-T, L-A-F-F-I-T-T, L-A-F-F-I-T-E, and more, all emerged between the river and the mountains. And for many, the song in their name was a siren's call to the broader world. Immediate access to the sea on the Bay of Biscay tied many of them to trade and seafaring. The lush vineyards on either side of the Garonne and the Gironde estuary formed at its confluence with the Dordogne River turned more of them into vintners. The ancient village of Pauillac, perched on the west bank of the Gironde estuary, exactly midway between Bordeaux and the Bay of Biscay at Pointe de Grave, some 30 miles distant. It was about as far up the estuary as the limited maneuverability of sail could bring ocean-going ships, making it a natural port for the merchants of Bordeaux and the surrounding region. Though small, it was already the informal capital of the Médoc, and just now starting to blossom thanks to the produce of its vineyards. One Lafitte family, and apparently only one of that spelling, lived in the village. Jean Lafitte and his wife, Anne Denis, saw their son Pierre marry Marie Lagrange in 1769, but the young woman died, perhaps giving birth to a son Pierre around 1770. In 1775, the father Pierre remarried, this time to Marguerite d'Estaing, who bore 6 children at their home in the little village of Bages, just south of Pauillac. 3 daughters lived to maturity, as did a son, Jean, born around 1782 or later, but not baptized until 1786. Most of the Lafittes living in the Bordeaux were solidly middle-class merchants and traders, and the elder Pierre Lafitte appears to have been in trade himself. Certainly he was able to give his 2 sons at least rudimentary schooling, though their written grammar, spelling, and syntax would never be better than mediocre. Whoever taught them to write, parent, priest, or schoolmaster, could not keep a natural independence out of their developing handwriting, for neither boy learned very good penmanship. But their teacher left some artifacts of his rote with them. All their lives the half-brothers signed their surname in identical fashion, lifting the pen from the paper midway and leaving a barely perceptible space before finishing, to produce Laf. Eat. What they might have made of themselves in France would never be known, for they were born into a changing and uncertain world, the Bourbon kings of France, living in increasing isolation among an inbred and calcified aristocracy, had long since lost touch with the people and the times. The emergent middle class, especially merchants like the Lafittes of the Bordeaux, felt crushed under the weight of taxation and church levies imposed to provide for the outrageous extravagance of the aristocracy and clergy. The Gironde became a seedbed of antipathy, and the Lafittes would not have been men of their class if they did not share the general outrage. It all came to an explosion in the summer of 1789. And by the fall of 1795, the people of the Bordeaux, like all Frenchmen, felt nervous exhaustion after 6 years of constant turmoil. By the time elections were held in October for delegates to a new convention to rule in Paris until a regular government should take over under a new constitution, Pierre Lafitte may well have been financially ruined, as were so many other merchants. Even as an ardent young captain named Napoleon Bonaparte saved both the convention and the new constitution by turning away an uprising that sought to disrupt the elections, Lafitte's sons Pierre and Jean could only look on what must have seemed a blighted future landscape. The son Pierre, his schooling long over, lived and probably worked with his father at number 49 Rue de la Délivrance in Bordeaux, trying to keep their business alive. Jean, perhaps aged about 14, likely saw his education disrupted by the turmoil that he had lived with for fully half his life. Just what each of them felt about it all he never said, but like many others of their class they imbibed a general, if not passionate, belief in local autonomy, as preferable to central rule from afar, and from the turmoil and dissolution in their immediate region they learned the lesson that in troublous times, on the frontiers of civil authority, the wise man took care of himself first. They may even have seen object lessons in how a man could profit during times of political and social upheaval if he was smart, daring, and none too scrupulous. A later acquaintance of the Lafittes recalled being told that the brothers had been contraband smugglers on the Spanish border during the times of scarcity, which would have been one way to combat severe price controls. And they were anyhow close enough to the Pyrenees to fall under the age-old lure of smuggling as a remedy from the greedy excise man. Whatever the Lafittes learned of making their way in the world, by the end of the decade it was evident to them that they would not make it in their native country. Economic recovery would take years, and even with a new constitution, and with the terror at an end, civil affairs remained shaky, or dependent on a military that was now embroiled in contests of arms all across Europe, and with England as well. Then, in December 1796, their father Pierre died. Thousands of Frenchmen from their region had emigrated, re-establishing themselves in the colonies in the New World, far from the reach of the Jacobins and the guillotine. Many a royalist had gone to Spanish Louisiana, and other colonies thrived on the islands of Saint-Domingue, Martinique, and Guadeloupe in the Caribbean. It was a natural direction to turn their eyes. And so, sometime in the last of that decade, they began disappearing, and completely. For years, barely a trace of them survives. A third brother, name unknown, may have left France first, or Jean may have gone about the turn of the century. Then on May 24, 1802, Pierre obtained a passport, saying he was going to Louisiana to join one of his brothers. Perhaps he was the same Pierre Lafitte from Pauillac, and his 1802 departure from Bordeaux was only the return from a visit home from the colony. Two-thirds of French commercial trade was with the island, which was half French and half Spanish, until 1795, when France got it all. French merchant ships called first at Cap Français, and some then went on to New Orleans, despite an official edict from Madrid prohibiting trade with the colonies of other powers, as well as restrictions imposed by Paris. If Pierre Lafitte was involved in trade at Port-au-Prince, then he might have had cause to know of, and perhaps even to visit New Orleans. Nevertheless, he found that he could not escape the Revolution. Once again, inept and corrupt rule from a great distance created unrest, here compounded by a large and resentful black population. Saint-Domingue had only 20,000 white inhabitants, while more than 100,000 free blacks and mulattoes owned one-third of the land, and a fourth of the 500,000 slaves in the colony, creating a hierarchy in which whites looked down on free blacks and mulattoes, who in turn looked down on slaves. A series of slave rebellions, beginning in 1790, sent waves of white planters fleeing the island. Whenever he first arrived in Saint-Domingue, Pierre Lafitte spent at least some time in Le Cap, as Cap Français was called. He may have been there to witness the fighting on June 20, 1793, when about 2,000 mariners and political prisoners on ships in the harbor rose and landed under arms to attack the government buildings. French commander Léger Félicité Sontonax won a temporary victory, but by the summer of 1794 the British, now at war with France, held Port-au-Prince, and the Pierre Lafitte living there left for Savannah, Georgia, with the flood of émigrés. But then, lured by Sontenac's declaration of emancipation, former slave Toussaint Louverture, now commanding most of the free black and slave forces, joined forces with the French to eject the British. By this time the Spanish were also involved, and in time both Britain and Spain would entrench themselves, trying to keep what they could of Saint-Domingue. Meanwhile, The Pierre Lafitte who left Port-au-Prince in 1794 returned once the British were contained. He may have been back in Le Cap in May 1800, when black workers rebelled in the north and thousands marched on Le Cap to take it back from the Spanish. Or he may have been there later in October 1801, when farm workers rose up and killed 300 white colonists. But most likely he was there in 1802 after sailing under his passport and making a stop on his way to Louisiana. In January 1802, Napoleon, now risen to emperor in France, sent an army under General Charles Leclerc to re-establish control. Instead, the French met disaster. Leclerc was soon all but besieged in Cap Français, and that summer he burned most of the town. In November he died of yellow fever, and his successor, General Donatien Rochambeau, resorted to wholesale extermination of blacks and mulattoes. Napoleon could not help him, as he had gone to war with Britain again in May, and in March 1803 the black population of Saint-Domingue rose again in revolt. Rochambeau holed up in Le Cap after losing control of the countryside, and was besieged, while British ships returned to establish a blockade of the harbor. By that time, Pierre Lafitte was most certainly gone for good. What role he took, if any, in the upheavals on the island is unknown. On May 10, 1802, as Pierre prepared to leave Bordeaux, an Antoine Lafitte was waylaid at Port Républicain and marched off with a number of other white citizens and was murdered. He may even have been the brother Pierre was going to visit. When Pierre arrived, he was himself caught in the street fighting in Cap Français. One day, on the Place Saint-Pierre, Lafitte and his friend, Bernard Narieux, and others, found themselves in the middle of the deadly swirl. Lafitte and Narieux escaped to safety, but not before they saw one of their acquaintances, a Mr. Gaboriot, whom Pierre may have known back in France, fall victim to the mob. It was a good time for Lafitte to be leaving, and where else to go but a place so many he knew had gone before him, a place with which he may well have had some acquaintance already, New Orleans. That spring and summer of 1803, French privateers began ferrying refugees to Cuba and New Orleans, getting out as many of the white French as possible before Rochambeau surrendered on November 29, 1803. Among the exiles was Jean-Joseph Aimable Humbert, a somewhat unstable visionary who went back to France, though his life would intertwine with the Lafittes in years to come. Also fleeing Saint-Domingue were a promising young architect named Arsène Latour, only recently arrived to take a position as engineer on Rochambeau's staff, and Barthélemy Lafont, a gifted surveyor who mixed privateering with map-making. Lafont escaped to Havana in 1802, and Latour got out some time before November 1803, and perhaps escaped on a privateer, first to Cuba, then to New Orleans. Like Humbert and many other refugees from Saint-Domingue, they would reappear in the Lafitte story, though nothing suggests that Pierre was acquainted with them in Cap Français. Pierre Lafitte left on one of those refugee ships no later than early March 1803, and if he went that late, then he did not go alone. By the time he put Saint-Domingue permanently behind him, Pierre Lafitte had an infant son. These are our realms, no limits to their sway. Our flag, the scepter, all who meet, obey. Ours the wild life in tumult still to range, from toil to rest, and joy in every change. 2. New Men in a New World, 1803-1806. In 1803, New Orleans was overwhelmingly a French community, though so many languages and colors were to be seen on its streets that it was truly a city of the world. It had changed hands often since its founding by the French in 1718. France had ceded the vast inland empire known as Louisiana to Spain in 1762, but in 1801, in the Treaty of Madrid, Napoleon reclaimed Louisiana as part of the spoils of his reduction of Spain to a vassal state. Now, even as Lafitte walked the streets of New Orleans, Napoleon was negotiating the sale of the Louisiana Territory to the infant United States. New Orleans itself made up several dozen square blocks of Creole and colonial houses on the northwest side of a crescent bend in the Mississippi River, all still encased in the remnants of an earthen rampart remaining from its earlier defenses. The Place d'Armes sat just back from the river, an open square on which stood the Cathedral Church of St. Louis, with the territorial prison and guardhouse to one side and an ecclesiastical charity house on the other. Street names redolent of French and Spanish history, Charters, Royal, Bourbon, Dauphine, Burgundy, and Rampart, paralleled the levee road at the river's edge. Intersecting them were others of equal association: Bienville, St. Louis, Conti, Toulouse, St. Pierre, Orleans, St. Anne, Dumaine, St. Philip, and more. Many of the blocks at the outer periphery close to the rampart were yet vacant, while to the east, beyond the rampart, already Faubourg Marigny was growing, mainly the home of the large free black and mulatto community. Pierre Lafitte may not have found re-establishing himself in New Orleans to be as easy as he could have hoped. In 1803, an arriving refugee faced paying $10 to $20 a month for lodging in a quiet suburb of town. Pierre first took rented quarters on Royal Street, probably near the intersection with Dumaine, while looking for a suitable venue to go into business. A newcomer had to pay $25 to $80 a month to rent a well-located commercial building. Instead of renting, however, on March 21st, and at a cost of 8,000 silver Spanish pesos, Pierre bought from the widow, Marguerite Landreau, a city lot one block east of the Place d'Armes, at the intersection of Royal and Dumaine. It came with a substantial house and outbuildings, including probably a small warehouse, if the selling price be any measure. The site had a mercantile history, having belonged until 1800 to the late Julien Vienne, an importer with Saint-Domingue connections who had operated two merchant vessels prior to his death, and who may well have done business with Lafitte in years past. Lafitte bought it in partnership with Joseph Maria Bourguignon, a member of a New Orleans family dating back at least to 1728. Bourguignon lived on Dumaine, and he and Pierre may have become acquainted when Lafitte took lodgings around the corner. Evidently they did not have much by way of cash in hand, however, for they promised to pay the widow half of the purchase price at the end of June, and the balance at the end of 1804. Within a few weeks Lafitte had to borrow 320 pesos from an innkeeper, the Spaniard Pedro Alarcón, who was known to conduct an unlawful gambling table that might have increased Pierre's indebtedness. Thereafter, Pierre's financial affairs reveal a chronic shortage of ready cash, and with it a tendency to live beyond either his means or his ability to manage his money. Indeed, only 11 weeks after signing the papers for the Royal Street property, Lafitte and Bourguignon returned it to Landreau in return for cancellation of their debt on June 6th, probably after finding that they could not make the first installment due at the end of that month. Pierre Lafitte had been a property owner for less than 3 months and would never own a house or land again. The exact nature of Lafitte's mercantile enterprise is unclear. But despite later myth and recollection to the contrary, it almost certainly was not ironworking. Dumaine in that period was known as the Street of the Stores, and would have been the place to be if Lafitte, like fully one-fourth of the other refugees from Saint-Domingue, was a merchant. He may have expected to import goods from abroad, or perhaps from Havana, but with so many newly arrived merchants in New Orleans added to the established houses, competition would have been keen, especially for a man of limited resources. In 1803, merchants led all other professions in the city, selling chiefly cargoes imported by ship. Most were middlemen who did not own the ships themselves, but already it was evident that the real fortunes would be made by men who controlled both the importation and sale of their wares. Doing that would require more capital than Pierre Lafitte could command at the moment, however, and more likely, he hoped to trade in goods from the Louisiana Territory interior, a market still being developed. Indeed, the crowding in New Orleans just then may have forced him to that alternative. Unfortunately for Pierre Lafitte, he arrived near the end of the massive immigration from Saint-Domingue. Refugees from the Haitian revolts arrived in New Orleans at a steady rate, starting at a trickle of about 100 per year from 1791 to 1797, and reaching more than 1,000 by 1803. The French-speaking community in the city welcomed the white arrivals, and at first they did not mind lots of Saint-Domingue slaves coming with them. By 1803, though, just under 4,000 whites were barely outnumbered by 4,100 blacks, a third of them free. Already, undercurrents of fear were palpable in the white community, especially with the example of Saint-Domingue, if not on their doorstep, then certainly in their front yard. Then there was the question of changing nationalities. Americans spreading into the Ohio and upper Mississippi River valleys needed the Mississippi for access to markets. The Spaniards had closed the port of New Orleans to them, effectively stifling trade, at the same time leaving America's back door vulnerable to European aggression. When Spain turned the Louisiana Territory over to an aggressive Napoleonic France in 1801, President Thomas Jefferson's anxiety for the infant United States' western border only heightened, as he expected Napoleon to keep the river closed. Moreover, with France at war with Britain, a British victory could put America's one-time colonial master in control of the Mississippi, with every manner of foreseeable unfortunate consequence. Rumors of an expedition being readied to invade Louisiana and take it from France only spurred Jefferson to action. Jefferson sent Robert Livingston and James Monroe to France to negotiate an open port at New Orleans and free trade for the United States. But changing circumstances in Europe made Napoleon amenable to much more than that, and in April 1803, Jefferson's emissaries were asked point-blank what they would pay for the Louisiana Territory. By the end of that month, Jefferson had all of it, from the Gulf of Mexico to the Pacific Northwest, including the so-called Island of New Orleans. That small portion of land east of the Mississippi running from the Gulf through Lake Bourne, west through Lake Pontchartrain on the city's northern outskirts, and thence through Lake Maurepas and along the Amette River and Bayou Manchac to its mouth on the Mississippi, 70 miles upstream from New Orleans. Above that lay the parishes of Spanish West Florida. Pierre Lafitte was probably in New Orleans on December 20, 1803, when the formal ceremony turning over the government of Louisiana took place on the Place d'Armes. General James Wilkinson and new territorial governor William C.C. Claiborne accepted the keys of the city from the French commissioner and then raised the flag of the United States, amidst the acclamations of the inhabitants, according to an American present. Many of the French and Spanish citizens saw the reaction rather differently, however, and one spoke of the lugubriousness of the silence and immobility among the Frenchmen and Spaniards and the locally born European Creoles. It would not be the last mark of a subdivision in the white community, nor of conflicting loyalties among the Europeans, that would one day make the livelihood of Pierre Lafitte and ultimately direct his destiny. Significantly, Jefferson sent several gunboats to New Orleans to protect order among what their naval commander David Porter regarded as a very turbulent population. Claiborne had already promised to the European community in New Orleans all the protections of United States citizens, and the carryover of all previous laws and civil officers, except those who collected the customs, who would now be federal appointees. Within months of the American takeover, the character of the city began to change, as its new masters imposed order on its chaotic streets and in its civil affairs. More new shops opened almost overnight as American merchants rushed to the city to capitalize on the new world marketplace. The influx increased the population.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?